Hi everyone, and welcome to Wild Tracking, Episode 4, Brumbies, Whalers and Horses at Anzac Cove.
We're back again.
We're back. It's been a bit of a break between podcasts, hasn't it? We've been in New Zealand for a wedding, and what else?
We've been distracted quite a bit, haven't we?
Yeah, we've been busy at the vet clinic as well, so it's just...
I got sent down to Cairns because I hit my head, so then if we did do a podcast then it wouldn't be me in it.
Yeah, so Harry's had a bit of time in Cairns Hospital, and what happened, Harry?
We were playing at school in the undercover area, and we were playing a really fun game, and it was like Bull Rush, but different,
because... Yeah.
When you got tagged, you had to stay still, and you had to try and tag other people, so it isn't Bull Rush.
Yeah, Octopus, isn't it?
Octopus, yep. Yeah. And I was running to go off and get someone, and then I ran straight into Phoenix, and I whiplashed the back of my head and got a concussion, so they sent me down to Cairns.
Right, okay. How did you get down to Cairns?
We got to go on the Flying Doctor's plane.
Yeah, Royal Flying Doctor Service. It's pretty cool, isn't it?
Everybody thought that I got flown out in the helicopter.
Well, I think the helicopters... Monty went in the helicopter when he had his... What was his brain thing? His herpes simplex. Herpes simplex and encephalitis.
But you get herpes.
But I think those helicopters are run by Queensland Health. But you guys went with the Royal Flying Doctors, who've got... they've got a fleet of aeroplanes sort of providing services to sort of outback Australia, and they're pretty cool. They go, to landing strips out at stations, and they provide healthcare for outback communities and things like that.
Stuff like that. Mm. Hey, I'm the only one out of Harry, Monty and I that hasn't been flown out of Cooktown so far with an illness or something.
No.
Xanthi, don't test it.
Yeah. I was going to say, you're the only one who's actually had a CAT scan, though, when you got stood on by that horse.
Oh, yeah.
I've had x-rays.
Mm. Anyway, so let's get back on topic. So speaking of horses... and
there's a book called War Horse, Dad.
There's a book called War Horse, yeah. So we've just had the
Anzac 100... Day.
Yeah, we've just had Anzac Day, the 25th of April. And it's 100 years since the Gallipoli, or the landings at Anzac Cove in Gallipoli. What do you know about the Gallipoli campaign?
Oh, I know. Okay. So the British wanted to conquer Turkey because if Turkey has this big inlet,
yes,
and they figured if they can get the Australian and New Zealand and all sorts of other country troops through there, they'll easily be able to make their way across the land straight into Germany so they can get it from all sides. But they didn't think through how large the Turkish defence force would be, because they got there and realised, hold on, there are 50 cannons in the where we need to pass through on boat.
Yep.
So they ended up stopping just outside the entrance to the place and going in on a bay. They're supposed to be nice and flat, and they'll be able to get in there. It'll just take a tiny bit longer.
Yeah.
And I got in and were instantly gunned down by how many Turkish soldiers were waiting?
Oh, crikey. Well, I don't know the exact figures, but I know they put at least 16,000 men ashore in the first 24 hours.
Yeah.
That was the Anzac forces, so the Australian New Zealand Armed Corps, reinforced by British Navy. And I think there are in excess of 30,000 Turks ashore as well. And yeah, they expected to find nice low-lying beaches, and they were going to land horses and all sorts of things.
And
they found the beaches weren't too bad, but then they had to climb up these huge cliffs.
And of course, on top of the cliffs, the Turkish soldiers were waiting with huge machine guns.
No, so it didn't... We're talking about the actual campaigns probably a little beyond the scope of this podcast, but they spent an utterly miserable 9 months dug in on this rather sandy, barren peninsula.
Yeah.
And they were eventually evacuated, I think, it was about 9 months later. So
apparently it took so long because they kept on saying, we can't do this, we've got to back out. And the British people kept on saying,
keep moving forward.
And
there was certainly, there's been some suggestion over the years that the British military control, so the Admiralty and the Army, were prepared to commit... the Anzac forces, the Australian and New Zealand forces, to tasks that they weren't perhaps prepared to commit their own forces to. And, it was tremendous attrition.
That's just called using people.
Dad, have you heard the story of the Gallipoli donkey?
No.
George the donkey. Wait,
his
no,
name wasn't George.
George.
I can't remember the donkey's name or...
John. His name was John something.
No, there was this dude that landed at Gallipoli and he went for a walk and found a wild donkey.
Yeah.
And he's like, I shall tame this donkey and use it to carry wounded people.
Okay.
So he tamed the donkey and it went really well because he like would run out in the middle of open gunfire and pick people up on his donkey and walk, march them back to safety.
Okay.
And I think... the donkey lived happily ever after, but the dude died after 3 weeks in Gallipoli or so?
2 weeks.
Okay. That's
he got shot down by
look,
a sniper.
Look, the casualties, I know there are in excess of 2,000 men died in the first 24 hours of the campaign. The casualties and sort of invoked by, incurred by the troops at Gallipoli were terrible. So, look, the thing I thought would be interesting was to talk about one of the most famous things about those Anzac forces were their light horses.
Yeah.
Have you guys ever heard of whalers?
I have, but Harry hasn't, so explain them to her.
Aren't they people that go off and kill whales?
No, different type of whalers.
It's a different type of whaler. So, whalers were the Australian light horse that was developed as a type of horse. The first horses that came over with the first fleet were co-mingled with things like Timor ponies, which is an Indonesian small pony.
Yeah, I heard they had Clydesdale, a lot of different
Clydesdales,
horses.
Percherons, the French heavy
Dad.
Horse. Yeah.
Why are they called whalers?
Because New South Wales. So New South Wales is the main state in the southeastern seaboard of Australia. Sydney is obviously the capital of New South Wales. And you guys have heard of the First Fleet, haven't you?
Yeah. I think so. Was it the first wave of people colonising Australia?
Well, it's always... this is the subject of some discussion because these were the first 11 ships that arrived from Britain to form a colony. And obviously on board were about half of the people were convicts. The formation of Australia was largely as a penal colony.
I like that, how you can basically say to any Australia to... annoy them.
Yes.
Remember that you were descended from the people Britain did not want to be in their country.
Exactly. The people that Britain kicked out.
Dad?
Yeah?
But the reason why Australians say H, it's because they were descended from people with a lower class education.
That's not entirely true, Harry.
But it's because H. a large wave of the first teachers in Australia were the Irish nuns.
Yep. Yeah, so Irish.
And Irish accent, they all say H instead of H.
Yep.
So large quantity of the first Australians were taught to say H.
Yep, no, so that's why you always hear Australians say H rather than the H that you hear from Americans, New Zealanders and...
every other basically, like, country in the world.
Every other English-speaking country in the world. Sometimes you hear the H from people in the Midlands, from Britain.
Yeah, because in Britain and a few countries like that, saying H is considered a sign of lower-class education.
Yeah, well, you have a working-class background, so... it sounds funny to our ear, doesn't it?
That's exactly what I was just... saying.
I know you were, Harry. Very good. We were back to New South Wales and the First Fleet. So they arrived at, I think it was Port Jackson.
They arrived at Sydney Harbour.
Well, no, they then went about 12 kilometres north to what is now Sydney Harbour.
Yeah.
And they called it Sydney Cove originally.
Yeah.
And so that was the first penal colony that was set up there. And, you had convicts, some of them had been sentenced, and they weren't hardened criminals, a lot of them. There were women, there were children, people had been sent for stealing, and often they were just trying to steal food and things like that to stay alive. So it wasn't as though Britain had sent all their hardened criminals here.
No, all the hardened criminals were hung. They just sent the people out that were bad enough not to want in their country, but good enough not to be murdered.
Dad, Mr. Gonnell said that how he got to Australia was that his great-grandfather stole a pig.
That's entirely possible. Yeah.
Pig theft. It's not okay for
you. Yeah. So, look, I think there's been a degree of, perhaps embarrassment from Australians as to, the formation. But I think the reality now is that people are pretty accepting of the fact. So anyway, let's get back to talking about the Whaler, which is these years. So they bought thoroughbred horses with them from Britain. And then over the next 50 to 100 years...
Dad, I was going to say, you know how we were just talking about Australians and sometimes a little bit embarrassed of their descendants?
Yeah.
That's like the shirt that I want to make that says on it, proud to be primate.
Proud of your religion as being a primate?
Yeah. I'm a monkey.
You're a monkey. All right. So these Whalers were quite a small horse. And these horses were sort of interbred between thoroughbred Arabs, Timor ponies that came from Indonesia, and to a certain extent Clydesdales and Percherons, which are a French heavy horse.
So they're sort of like the horse mutt.
Yeah, they were. They were kind of like a mongrel breed, but they were very suitable for Australian conditions. And became very famous and known as basically the Australian light horse. So in the Boer War and in the First World War, these in excess of 500,000 horses were exported from New South Wales to all over the world because they were just such fantastic horses.
Apparently they're brilliant. You can meet one that's not even well broken and it will be perfectly calm most of the time about everything.
Yeah. So they're very calm temperament. They had to carry quite a lot of weight. They would have had to carry their rider, and with their rider, he would have had a rifle, 90 to 100 rounds of 303 ammunition. He would have carried a couple of horseshoes, some nails, his bedroll, and provisions. He'd have to carry grain for the horse and food for himself. So these horses carried somewhere in the region of 130 kilos.
That's sort of like they were kind of the workhorse, weren't they?
Yeah, so they were just an incredible workhorse. And I often hear people these days, they're worried about how much weight their horses can carry. You know, they don't want people who weigh, 100 kilo to ride their horse.
No,
and they just don't realise how incredibly strong horses are.
There's a reason it's called horsepower, people.
Yeah, exactly.
Pony power.
Yeah, so horses can carry an incredible amount of weight over long distances. And the other thing that was amazing about these Whalers, these Australian light horses, they seem to be able to do without water. The horses typically need about 30 litres of water a day. And quite often these horses could go 3 days without water and still, still be ridden and still were able to carry on.
That's so, a good horse.
Yeah, they're incredibly, they were very in demand from the British Army. Yeah, they were very popular horses.
What happened to that? You don't see the army using horses anymore because they're like...
So old-fashioned.
So old-fashioned. We've got motorbikes that carry four people at once now.
I think that the reality is you only really see horses in ceremonial roles now, don't you?
Yeah.
There are still horses used...
In the police force.
Yeah, the British police use horses for riot control. They're very good for crowd control. Because you're up high and you can see what's going on.
And you can step on people's toes.
Well, that's potential.
And also, no one's going to mess with a huge horse. No one's going to
mess with a horse, that's
apparently
for sure.
They're used as, casual police officers use horses around New York. Like, in New York where it's quite hard to get a car in there.
Yeah. So you can move, particularly I think there's horseback police around Central Park in New York.
What do they do about the poop?
They probably it just gets cleaned up by street sweepers and things like that. Let's roll back to what we're talking about.
Whalers,
yeah. So it's interesting, there's been quite a move recently for whaler preservation.
Yes, because apparently at one time a lot of them were set loose into the Australian bush because simply stations couldn't afford to keep them anymore and they weren't too much use. Is that the story? I don't know too well about it, but apparently they just let all these horses loose.
Yeah.
And loads of them...
Sorry.
they let all the horses loose in the Australian bush.
Yep.
And then lots of pest control happened around brumbies and stuff, so yep. a lot of the whalers started to be hunted down.
Yeah, that's a good point. What's a brumbie, Harry?
No, I've got another thing.
Yeah.
That I just had an amazing idea, that maybe those horses were actually whalers.
Which horses?
Whalers.
What?
You're going to have to explain yourself better than that, Harry.
Whalers are whalers.
Okay. Perhaps we'll edit that out later.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's one of the things that they're looking at. The sort of sport horse in Australia has now been diluted quite heavily with quarter horses from America.
Yep.
Now, there's nothing particularly wrong with quarter horses, but the modern sort of horse that you see at the show days at Australia now isn't really representative of that original Australian stock horse or Australian light horse.
No, most horses nowadays seem to be the same sort of body type, at least loads of the ones we see.
Yeah, so yeah, we've got that quarter horse with their much more muscular rump.
Big booty.
Yeah, big booty horse, yes. So, and yeah, there's a number of societies in Australia now trying to preserve that whaler type. So a smaller, lighter horse, often with a little bit of feathering around the feet. And and moving away from that sort of quarter horse type.
Apparently, just one thing about whalers. Apparently, they're extremely quiet horses. Like, that's why they were such good use in Gallipoli in the wars, because they could break from a walk into a canter almost silently.
Yep, that's
one of today's horses.
Yeah, no, that's one of the things that they could walk quickly. And we've certainly, do you remember our horse Rebel, who was a standard bred? He had an incredibly fast walk.
He could go very quickly.
So he could really cover ground at a walk, which is comfortable for the rider. But the whaler was able to go into what's called a level canter very quickly.
And they're extremely comfortable to ride.
Very comfortable to ride. You don't want to trot a horse. Trotting makes a lot of noise. You get this big double beat noise when you're trotting a horse, and it's also very, very tough on the rider trotting for a long period of
very bouncy trotting.
Yeah, it's a bouncy two-beat gait, and it's pretty uncomfortable for long periods of time. So, that was one of the characteristics of the whaler, was the very rapid walk and then transferring into a level canter very quickly. And obviously they were, you know, cantering with this 130 kilos of rider and equipment on their back. So,
how fat were these riders that they were on?
Well, that's a good question, actually, Harry, because I think one of the things you notice these days, people are heavier than they are now.
Definitely.
Probably your average Australian and New Zealand infantryman, you know, was considerably shorter and lighter.
A lot smaller and lighter.
Yeah.
So, like jockeys.
Jockeys, I guess, these days are chosen deliberately to be light. But it's interesting. I remember at my wedding, when I got married, it was really interesting to see. There was my father and my brother, Ali, and I'm 6'2", and Ali 6'7", standing next to my father, who was born in 1941, and he's about 6 foot, and next to his father at about 5'9", who was born in 1910. So just an indication of just how humans have actually got bigger, and it's largely nutrition as a child.
Yes.
That, we've grown up, you know, this is all three of us. I was born in 1971, Xanthi in 2001, and Harry in 2004. You know, we've grown up where we've never had a hungry day in our lives, have we?
No. Except maybe those 2 days on the boat where we ran out of food and we're eating stale biscuits and icing sugar.
That's true. Okay,
that was
so
yummy.
We had two horrific days where we didn't have food.
Two horrific starvation days.
Yeah, and look, it's interesting. Even my mother had a ration book, so in post-war Britain. My mother was born in India during 1943 and then grew up in Britain in that post-war period. You know, food was rationed then. So, you were only allowed, you know, 3 eggs a week, that sort of thing. So
yeah.
It just goes to show you, and it's only a generation ago, people, you know, went hungry quite a lot of the time.
They still do today in lots of other developing countries.
Oh, no question about that at all, Xanthi.
Dad?
Yeah?
You know what I said before about the whalers are whalers? a million that whaler horses might be whalers.
Harry, nobody understands what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Whaler horses could be people who kill whales.
Yeah, whales, W-A-L-E-S, the country in Britain.
I thought you were talking about whaler people.
Yeah, so those original settlers, you know, called the area around where they settled New South Wales because the hills reminded them of South Wales.
Dad!
Yes?
How about whalers are from Wales and they also have whalers?
What do you know about Brumbies, Harry?
That they're wild horses and that they're a football, rugby team?
Yeah, that's one of the really interesting things. So there's about 500,000 wild or feral horses in Australia.
Yeah, we've seen some out on, even just out driving to do horses.
So yeah, we saw some in Bloomfield National Park the other day.
They had foals with them, and they were actually not too startled when we drove by. They just sort of looked at us and were like, mm-hmm.
No, they're pretty humanised. They're pretty used to seeing people. And yeah, there are big groups of Brumbies in the Blue Mountains around Sydney, and there's a big group of Brumbies in Western Australia and in Northern Territories as well.
How large is the big group of Brumbies?
Well, we're talking about, they estimate about 500,000 horses across Australia, and it's a really interesting political issue. And for a number of reasons. Harry just mentioned that there's the ACT, the Australian Capital Territories Brumbies, as their rugby team. So people identify Brumbies as being majestic wild animals.
The truth is they're mutt horses.
Well, the reality is they are non-native species, which do have an impact on the Australian environment.
Mm.
One of the things about horses is always, people are very emotionally attached to horses.
Yes, people
always
have been.
They're like a pet.
Yeah, so it's interesting. For example, a lot of countries eat, the French love to eat horse.
I wonder what it tastes like.
Whereas the Americans are so attached to horses, you're not allowed to process horse meat for human use. So you're not allowed to eat horse in America. Whereas the French absolutely love it.
does horse taste of? Are we allowed to get horse?
I'm told it's like a stringy beef,
for
want of a better description.
Do you know that you can have a horse cook steak? I've heard about the Huns back when they were invading China, all that stuff. They would be able to put a real steak between the saddle blanket and their horse's saddle.
Yeah.
And the horse would heat up so much that you could take it out 4 hours later and it would be cooked.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool.
There's some good horses.
Right, so I've just had a brief pause here just to have a look at some horse meat consumption things.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting. Countries that eat horses. Mexico eats 78,000 tonnes of horse meat a year. Argentina, Kazakhstan, Mongolia, Kyrgyzstan, Australia eats 24,000 tons of horse meat.
Why can't we get horses?
You see, I'm surprised by that because I suspect probably what that means is Australia actually processes the horses and it's exported for use in those countries that really like horse meat. I've never seen horse meat. Here we go. Australians do not generally eat horse meat, although they have a large horse slaughter industry that exports to Japan, Europe, and Russia. So that's interesting, isn't it?
I really, really, really want to try and eat some horse now.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see whether we could find some. Have you ever eaten kangaroo?
Nope.
Yeah, Mum and I had kangaroo at the restaurant here the other day, and it was really surprisingly good. So it's it's interesting to try some different meats.
There wouldn't be very much meat on a kangaroo, would there? There's more leg than anything. It's like gigantic chicken leg, but kangaroo leg.
Yes, yeah. Like a kangaroo drumstick. Yeah. So, imagine eating an emu drumstick.
Yeah.
Yummo. That'd be cool. So, guys, I thought one of the things we could just talk about briefly is just it's really interesting how in two generations our relationship with horses have really changed. For example, both your grandfathers, Grandpa Murdoch and Granddad Hop, used to ride horses to school every day. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you'd get to school, you'd take the bridle and saddle off your pony and put it on the fence, and you just let your pony out into the paddock, and then at the end of the day you'd catch your horse and put the bridle and the saddle on and you'd ride home.
Wish we could do that nowadays. Like, why don't we install a horse that's why you have, at our school?
That's why you have bicycles, I think. It really is just the relationship. The motor car has really just, has taken over so many of those functions. But just a brief plug, my great aunt, whose name is Marty Smith, she's actually a lady. Marty is a nickname. Mm. And you can
Martha?
Find... Yeah, no, her name is Margaret, but you can find her at www.martysmith.com. She's written a really interesting book of poetry called Horse with Hat, and it's about her relationship with her father and the way they used horses. And it's just a really interesting snapshot of New Zealand. During that period, post-war, post-Second World War in New Zealand, when they were using horses for transport. For any New Zealanders, that's a really interesting book to have a look at. What have we got coming up?
Discovery Festival, I
know. Yeah, we've got Cooktown Discovery Festival coming up, and I have to dress up, apparently. Because I'm tall, I'm being dressed up as a Marine. So, 6th to the 8th of June... Cooktown has a festival which celebrates the 1770 arrival of Captain Cook. So my understanding is Cook ran the Endeavour aground on Endeavour Reef, didn't they?
Yes, and then they realised, oh no, and they're like...
Well, the ship was sinking, wasn't it? They were pumping the ship out.
And then they remembered... Then they remembered the Cooktown Inlet. They're like, we'll go and beach our boat in that river, and there's that bunch of islands over there. We'll call them the Hope Islands, because if something goes wrong, we'll go over there and try to fix the boat.
Yeah, so they were moving north with the boat leaking, and they were sending out, rowing boats, which they called lighters, didn't they? Sort of the light boats that they carried, and they were casting out ahead to look for somewhere where they could get the boat up onto the dry to fix it up, and they found the Hope Islands, and they named those because they figured if the worst came to the worst, they could run the ship aground there. But then about 40 kilometres north of that, they found the entry to the Endeavour River, which is where Cooktown is now. They had just under 2 months here, and apparently they were very lucky. The area they picked was an area the local Aborigines had set aside for meetings between tribes, and you weren't allowed to create battle or war.
That's a very lucky place.
Yeah,
to
so it was a very lucky place to come ashore, and he had very cordial relationships with the local Aborigines, and so it was really probably an important part of the foundation of Australia and Banks created, so Joseph Banks collected a whole lot of both biological and, so plant and animal samples. So did a lot of work on the original, the flora and fauna of Australia.
And loads of the Australian names that are derived from Aborigine words come from here, because this is where Cook saw his first kangaroo.
First kangaroo, yes.
So gungaroo is one of the local words for kangaroo.
Yeah, so nungaroo is the name of the male eastern grey kangaroo, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's where they got the name kangaroo.
Do you know what the name for a male and a female kangaroo are?
No.
A boomer
and a flyer.
Oh, a boomer and a flyer.
A boomer is a male, a flyer is a girl.
And the young ones are called?
Wallabies.
Joeys,
I mean, not wallabies.
Wallabies.
No, wallabies are midget kangaroos.
So, a couple of things. We are planning to take the yacht down to Port Douglas. We're going to need to pull the boat out and do the rudder and put some new antifoul on. We had a small incident with our drone. We lost it.
Not a small incident, Dad.
Okay.
We were
I'm playing it down because I'm flying it. It was a small incident and we lost our drone.
Dad was flying the drone and it went out of sight and we never found it again.
So we've lost our drone. The DJI are about to release the Phantom 3. So we are holding out for a new DJI Phantom 3. Which will be fantastic. It's got a built-in 360-degree camera, so that should be a bit of fun when that arrives. You can find us at www.wildtracking.net. You can find us on Twitter at wildtracking and on Facebook at wildtracking. If you want to listen to us, you can find us at www.stitcher.com. And if you search for wildtracking, you'll find us there. And of course, you can always find us at iTunes Podcasts. If you want to create an RSS feed, you can just do that off our wildtracking.net site. And as a final thing for our Anzac Day special episode, Xanthi is going to read a short story that she wrote about the Anzac Day landings. So are we going to tack that on the end, Xanthi?
Yeah,
we gonna...
I think we'll tack it on to the
end. Yeah, we'll tack it on the end. So Xanthi's poem's coming up next. And we will see you, everyone, next week. So bye, everyone.
Bye. The cool night air surrounds me. There is no sound other than the lapping of waves against the boat hull and splashes as oars stroke the water. The clunking of oars surrounds us as invisible boats slice through the water, all headed towards the same place. Darkness is like a blanket that covers everything except the sky, where a dull glow indicates a moon is also blocked by the clouds. There is a glow of luminescence as a hand dangles in the water. The brief glow of blue vanishes as the boy whips his hand out of the water as a soldier hisses at him, the words unintelligible. We were told earlier to keep quiet as we boarded the rowboats. All you need to do is claim the beach. A few Turkish soldiers may be defending the cove, but it is flat enough for you to storm by force. Just don't make any noise to alert them to where you are. That seems like hours ago, and all threats seemed far away as the calm of the night stills everything. The men rowing pull the oars aboard as the sound of waves breaking approaches us. For a moment, as the sound of the boat scraping sand breaks the silence, a cloud shifts. For a second, moonlight covers everything across the beach. High cliffs and jagged rocks are all I see. There's also something else, a reflection of light at the top of the cliffs, a glint of metal. My cry is unheard as the night air is ripped open by sound. The man next to me slumps as bullets pierce the water. Yells fill the air and calamity reigns. I topple into the water. I dive behind the boat as another wave of gunfire pierces the water. I half run, half crawl to the beach as those around me do the same. They fall as we try to make progress up the beach. How could this be happening is the only thought I can process. All I know is that I need to get to the hill. The people who surround me either charge or fire back into the darkness, their sights trained on invisible threat. They continue to fall like puppets with their strings cut. As I sprint towards the dark mass I know means safety, I smash into others, who I neither knew nor cared. I see the boy trailing his fingers in the water, the man slumping forward in the boat, my yell in the darkness, a second too late. So much can happen so quickly. I fall as more bullets sound around me. All I can do is crawl towards where safety may be, the rocks. Groping in the air around me, the darkness seems thicker than ever. I feel something solid, the hill. I dive behind the stones where my friends should be, but none of them are. Other soldiers surround me, but none I know. I think of the reflection I saw before the chaos surrounded us. The shine of a gun, the finger on the trigger. We should have known, should have foreseen this, and should have had a second plan. But we didn't, which is why all there is left to do is wait for the light to come. The sun to rise and reveal what was hidden in darkness. The sun which will reveal those we have lost and the mistakes we have made. The sun many of my friends will never see again.